Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. The title of this broadcast is World Watchers. It is program number 809, June the 8th, 1987. I don't know how many of my listeners to World Watchers are watching CNN or C-SPAN, the video program, the entertainment of the week, the Iran-Contra hearings, or listening to Pacifica Radio. But for those who are fortunate enough to have the time to listen or videotape or tape, record, which I'm doing, it is the most amazing experience I've ever had in all the years of my research. Every day there's one shock after the other, and it's really amazing, and I want to discuss some of that and share it with you, and some details that aren't coming across, of course, in the questioning, in the line of questioning. Last week on World Watchers, I left off by mentioning Richard von Weizsäcker, the president of Germany, coming to Harvard University to give the graduation commencement speech and or to be honored by Harvard University, and how his father was appointed by Heinrich Himmler to be on his personal staff of the Waffen-SS, and his father was promoted along with others to the very highest echelon of Adolf Hitler's regime, and then went on to represent Adolf Hitler at the Vatican. His son, who's the current guest at Harvard and the president of Germany, was a lawyer at that time period and defended his father and wrote about his father's work and his appeal and how ignorant he was of mass murders, even though he was the head of the Waffen-SS who ran the camps and didn't understand about the atrocities and never really read about them and didn't know that Hitler was going this far and so forth. So he became an apologist for the behavior of the Waffen-SS and for his father and for Adolf Hitler. Now, in San Jose, there's a small college, very small, that invited Tom Hayden, the other side of the coin, to speak at their graduation ceremonies. And it seems that it's in an area where 40% of the graduating students come from the Vietnamese community. And the Vietnamese newspapers ran ads about Tom Hayden being a traitor. They said they hate him, that he was visiting with his wife, Jane Fonda, the North Vietnamese, and a gentleman part of the Saigon Police Department said they would have vigils and get up and stand up and walk away at the graduation when he came on. Somebody in San Jose made a remark, it appears the forces that corrupted Saigon and lost the war in Vietnam, who Mr. Hayden opposed, have regrouped in San Jose, and these people don't understand freedom in Saigon, and they still don't understand freedom in San Jose, and they said it would be a bad or fitting thing to remember the 58,000 who died in Vietnam by having Tom Hayden speak. But on the other hand, we might assume that 58,000 died protecting free speech, and therefore they got their way and he stepped back. When you take that one step back, that I'm not going to come to graduation, I'm going to take orders from you, after he was invited to be there by people who have been invited to this country, you are starting a process by which there's no returning if you bow down to these kinds of pressures. And he doesn't have to apologize for what he did then, because that Vietnamese administration was so horrible. The people themselves didn't like them or want them, and that's why they were forced to flee. So Harvard has Richard von Weizsäcker with nobody standing up or leaving or objecting, evidently, in a two-year college in San Jose can't have Tom Hayden speaking, whereas this is the 20th year since the large anti-war movement began. And the people who protested the war were absolutely right, it seems, about the things that we were doing and that the Saigon officials were doing. This morning, there was a Briton, let me see if I can pronounce it, Scironi, on the telly and on the radio, a witness before the Iran-Contra group, talking about a very questionable document, the Boland Amendment, how it applied to the president or the National Security Council, as against just the CIA or Defense Department. And Mr. Scironi is presently the attorney for the Intelligence Oversight Board that advises the president whether the actions he's taking are legal or illegal. And it was just amazing to hear him get on the stand and show his credentials, the lack of credentials, by which the chief attorney and this one attorney, he has a desk in the executive office, the old executive office suite, close to the CIA and National Security Council, and he's cozy with all of them. and they went into his background, upon which he based the decision that the Boland Amendment didn't apply to the National Security Council, but then he didn't spread it around among other people. He locked it in his safe, and nobody saw it. So I'm wondering if it was an accessory after the fact. But Mr. Boland, Representative Boland, said, I found Mr. Scaroni's testimony to be useful and instructive, and it illustrates how legal opinions were used by the White House. When there were articles in the New York Times, one particularly August 8, 1985, that Oliver North was supplying the Contras with military aid, he called Oliver North in and he said, did you do it? And he said, no, he didn't. So he said, I talked with him for 5 minutes. Then he called Robert McFarlane in and said, are you doing these things? And they talked for 30 minutes, and the National Security Advisor said no. So he was satisfied. This is the Intelligence Oversight Board. He was perfectly satisfied with that answer, and then it dropped there. And he, in his safe was a document saying that the NSC did not have to obey the rules of the Boland Amendment. And Representative Sarborn said, and they brought this up earlier, I'm interested in how you got your job. How much do you earn? And he said $62,000 a year. And earlier he said he graduated from UCLA Law School, and it took 4 or 5 years to pass the bar. And so he said he took his California bar, and he lost. He didn't pass it. He went to the Hoover Institute under Mr. Campbell, who was one of the three people on the Intelligence Oversight Board. He went right with him to Washington, so he was with his boss. Instead of overseeing him, he was his boss. And then he took the California bar again and failed. Then he went to work for the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, which is a hawkish institute with persons, you know, ready to make an invasion of Russia if necessary, and of course to wipe out the Nicaraguan forces there, the Sandinistas. So he went to the American Enterprise Institute, and he took the Washington bar, and he failed. And he took it again, and he failed. And they told him if he goes to Pennsylvania and go to Philadelphia and take it, then you can come back to Washington. So he did that, and they asked him how he got the job. Where was there a description of your qualifications? And he said no, he got it. Somebody ahead of him told him about it, so he simply applied and slipped into the job. And they said, did you start this job as a lawyer? Because the requirement was that you had to be a certified lawyer. And he said no, that he took the bar in July, and the next day went to work for the Intelligence Oversight Board, but he only had been taken the test in Philadelphia. This was his fifth time at the test, but he started to work the day after he took the test, and he didn't hear until the fall whether or not he had passed it. And it was illegal, of course, to hire. The stipulations were that they wanted an attorney, and he never practiced law and did any kind of discovery and never worked with covert action. And lucky for him, he passed the bar in July, rather in the fall, but he was already working for the Intelligence Oversight Board, and they asked him how many people you have to investigate whether or not these activities would be illegal, to warn the president or to tell the Justice Department to pursue them and FBI to go into them and see if there's illegalities. And he skirted around the possibility that he would tell them. He said he only had one secretary. It was him and his secretary that were the Intelligence Oversight Board. And they asked him, did you go to the press? And this is very significant. Did you go to the source of the press, the New York Times article, August the 8th, 1985, and ask them where they got the information? And he said, we don't contact the press. So the only thing that is true in these administrations is what they find for themselves. And through the whole entire Iran-Contra hearings, the fact came up that a lot of people, Robert McFarlane and the whole team, I could list all 8 or 10 that have been called so far, would say, I learned it in the newspaper. I didn't know this. As a matter of fact, the worst extension of that whole newspaper story was when Albert Hakim was telling about sending Mr. Zucker from Geneva, Switzerland, to Pennsylvania, where his offices are also in Pennsylvania. Maybe they write the law degree for these people. And he was meeting with Oliver North's wife, who went from Virginia to Pennsylvania to meet him. And Mr. Hakim, Albert Hakim, is saying how much he loves Ollie and loves the family and was setting up money for the children. And they asked him, do you know the name of his wife? He never met her, didn't know her. He said, I read it in the Washington Post this morning. It's Betsy. So that's where they get their information, the New York Times and Washington Post. But they're not allowed to use it as information to be pursued, and these diligent reporters are getting all these stories, and the intelligence community only tells you what they want to know, and anything that comes from the outside didn't happen unless they get the kosher seal that they are forced to go into it. So that was very revealing that they don't go to the source of the newspaper and find out if it's wrong. Now, this morning's Jack Anderson column it's about George Bush. Bush is implicated, and of course he's implicated. He's implicated sitting on the National Security Council while this is going on as vice president. He's linked to the Iranian affair, the Contra affair. But Jack Anderson said that his assistant, of course, Donald Gregg, was meeting with Mr. Gomez Rodriguez. And it's interesting that CIA agent Gomez Felix Rodriguez Dash, or Max Gomez, the same person with the two names, it's interesting that the documents about Gomez Dash Rodriguez are the things that possibly will bring George Bush down, because I've known for years, or was told for years, the relationship of George Bush to Klaus Barbie, and even the allegations or the stories that he met him in San Francisco, which have never, of course, been proven. I've mentioned a lot of times. And Gomez Dash Rodriguez, I've gone into his role, and I have a lot more I will detail one of these weeks pretty soon on killing Che Guevara along with Klaus Barbie. So it's interesting that the memos that involve George Bush and his office and Mr. Gomez Dash Rodriguez and his assistant, Mr. Gregg, will bring Bush out of office after he was at least bring him down out of running or winning the presidency. I don't know if they'll kick him out like they did Agnew. I don't know how far this team is willing to go. They did not fill with energetic reasons to scold these people for doing the things they did. But the noose around his neck is the Gomez-Rodriguez one, which was evident from the moment that Mr. Hassenfuss landed in the grass in Nicaragua and he opened his newborn eyes and said, Robert Owen and Gomez-Rodriguez, and that led right to the door of George Bush. Now, the key to the George Bush Gomez-Rodriguez has to do with a man named William Hetrick, who I've described on the year before. The San Francisco Chronicle had an article about him August 25th, 1984. This is the man, the pilot, that was charged with drug smuggling, who was arrested in Miami and pleaded. He was taken to Los Angeles then, and he pleaded that he would serve his time if his two sons, Buzz and Jinx, his stepson, James Coward, who were in business with him, monkey business with him, were not indicted. And this man, this Hetrick, and his links to Edwin Wilson would be the links of George Bush to Klaus Barbie and the cocaine that came in from Klaus Barbie to John DeLorean. But I had that on the year quite a few years ago already. It's been 4 years, 3 years, going on four. And I believe that this story is the bottom line, and I mention it because as these other persons made the circle to close in on George Bush, someday in our lifetime we're going to see that. Now, you've been reading a lot of the things that Albert Hakim has been saying, and those of you who get parts of the hearings know that he was a pretty dangerous man who had unlimited money and is holding on to millions and doesn't intend to give them up. And one of the scary things about Hakim, he was talking about the importance of the hostages, getting them home for the election in 1986 of the Republicans in the Senate and House. And evidently the big hunks of money for the hostages was to build up the psychological support which Ronald Reagan wants for those tele-sweeping gestures of the hostages marching home so he wouldn't have to suffer with the same problems that Jimmy Carter had. Now, with all their secret dealings, and there's no time in 1 hour a week to even go into them, there was an article in the Los Angeles Times, February 14th, 1987, about Albert Hakim, and it tells, among other things, which I'll go into, he married a Korean woman just in 1982, 1 year before the KAL went down. But Albert Hakim was working with members of Congress, and this article from the LA Times said that when Richard Secord retired from the Air Force in 1983, and of course we know he went on to those special operation groups, he became a director of Stanford Technology, a position he kept until December, and his contacts had brought him promises of deals. In 1984, this is when Ronald Reagan was reelected, Ernie Garcia, the sergeant of arms for the Senate, asked Secord and Stanford Technology to assess the U.S. capital needs. This is like James McCord, who was caught at Watergate, being chief of security for the CIA compound and the committee to reelect the president. But this gentleman, Ernie Garcia, was considering Secord Hakim to be in charge of the security for the United States Capitol. The article goes on, Stanford Technology prepared the report for free in hopes that they would have a leg up when the Senate was ready to grant a contract for providing the Capitol for security. But now the project is dormant because the Senate changed hands last month from Republican to Democrat. So the job that would be coming up for chief of security for the Capitol for the Senate and House could be handled by Secord and Hakim, who handled the security and the police, the Savak for the Shah of Iran, worked together in Iran, and these men would have access through every door and every person to letters of congressmen, to things they say, to speeches they're going to give, to people they see. Imagine what access they would have if they were assigned the job of being in charge of the security for the Capitol of Washington, D.C., working out of Switzerland with various banking institutions and dummy fronts. And goodness knows, as I say, what would happen to the electoral process. We're moving quickly to the electoral process in Germany in 1933. But given that little piece of information, imagine what else would happen. Now, there was an article, February 26, 1987, Oliver North described as a central figure in the Contra Fund. And I want to bring this up because the testimony that they're citing was Mrs. McLaughlin, who surfaced. She worked for Carl Spitz Channel, the conservative fundraiser who was close to Fawn Hall, to Ollie North, Robert Owen, the whole inner team. He was the man raising money for the electoral process to defeat the Democrats, working night and day. So people like Secord and Hakim, who handled their money in Switzerland, would have the security of the Capitol. And Mrs. McLaughlin said that she and her colleagues at the office often referred to Colonel North as the code name Green. In the interviews, she talked about meetings, and they were green meetings. The quote is green meetings that Oliver North used. And today, Fawn Hall testified that the name Green was one of the names used by Ollie North. Now, people associate green with money, and the Spitz Channel office was raising the money to change the electoral process or the House and Senate, and it is very important to know where the money was deposited, again with Mr. Willard Zucker, who was given the money, whether it was from various countries or private individuals like Mrs. Garwood and Joseph Kerr, or whether it was allegedly coming in from Brunei for the Contras or whatever purposes. Remember, that money was supposed to be 30% for the Contras, and nobody discussed at the hearings who got the other 70%, which is $7 million, $3 million for the Contras and $7 million undisclosed. And there is a lot of money that went through the offices, millions and billions of Willard Zucker and approximately $43 million of Albert Hakim. So green is money. And the discussions these last days have been about money and Ollie North and the enterprise and people like the National Security Council advisor and Robert McFarlane and then Admiral Poindexter putting it into the hands of Willard Zucker. Now, Hakim used Willard Zucker. Zucker was a former official of the Internal Revenue in the United States who moved to Switzerland. Later, he was an investment partner who took over the IOS, the Bernie Kornfield operation, and worked with Robert Vesco when he stepped into that space. Vesco having absconded with over $200 million, I believe it was, so there's another little bit of money. Now, Ronald Reagan's closest friend in California, and until he passed away, was Alfred Bloomingdale, who shared a mistress, Vicky Morgan, with Bernie Kornfield simultaneously. And at this time, Bernie Kornfield was close to Mr. Zucker and Robert Vesco, and he was on the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. He was on the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board with Edward Bennett Williams, who is one of the attorneys for Robert Vesco. And that's very important for this story as it evolves. And Roy Cohn also sat on the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, a longtime associate of Ronald Reagan's and the House on Americans activity, an attorney for Senator Joe McCarthy, And he was probably the first person out of that Spitz Channel office that died of AIDS. He was on the board of Western Goals, as well as serving in the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. Now, Roy Cohn was close to Spitz Channel in the circle, raising the money, which he was able to do, too. He had a lot of clients who were organized crime, some of the biggies of New York City and around the world, and he served, as I say, with Western Goals and Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. Now, Robert Vesco, the associate of Edward Bennett Williams, and this takes a little thinking, I'll have to diagram it for you, the client, as I say, of Edward Bennett Williams and also of Arthur Lyman, who's the chief counsel on this investigation of the Iran-Contra, and also a partner with Willard Zucker, who handles all their money, Vesco and another association business partner that also brought in a lot of money. And that was Mr. Carlos Letterivas, who's now sitting in a jail, the cocaine king from Colombia. And as I mentioned before, Rivas's partner with Vesco, he had several partners. One is Pablo Escobar and Jorge Osha, two defendants in the Christic Institute that worked with Albert Hakim, also a defendant, Richard Secord, Thomas Kleins, coming right out of the same operation that Mr. Hakim is talking about and Mr. Dutton worked for, Robert Dutton worked for. So that Vesco touches all these bases and touches the banking field of the persons who are going to take the NSC money and deposit it there, and also is the client of a person, Edward Bennett Williams, on the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. So that the president is a stone's throw away and in his NSC group, in his operations, where Ollie North taps into Hakim and Secord and the money goes into Zucker. It's a web that's been going on for a long, long time, and it taps directly into those people who've been fingered by the Christic Institute as the gun runners, the assassins, and their history webs, as I say, a long, long time. So with Vesco, the partner of Zucker, we heard a lot about Zucker's relationship to Albert Hakim this past week, but not a lot about who Mr. Zucker is or how Mr. Zucker happens to be meeting with Mrs. Ollie North, who goes from Virginia to Philadelphia. We know she's going there to make arrangements of some kind to get a hunk of money for her adorable husband, whose nickname is Belly Button. But Zucker is not identified, and yet Mrs. North goes there, and they should have given a little background that his client is Robert Vesco, or his business partner is Robert Vesco, who's the partner with the cocaine group down in Colombia. But anyway, in this network of people, this Carlos Letterivas also used the name Green, just as Ollie North was called Green, and we're talking again about a lot of money. Carlos Letterivas had a newspaper in Colombia that was green. It was printed on green paper. It had green ink, and he was directly tied into what he called the Green Nazi Party because they're fanatical environmentalists. So green could mean environment, and green could mean money. But the paper was filled with anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism, praised Adolf Hitler, wanted to legalize drugs, wanted a healthier race, and get into some nice genocide by cleaning out the race, which was the original goal of Hitler when he was stopped for a few years. Now, as well as green meaning money, the Sultan of Brunei was tapped, and I'll go into that. As I say, the $3 million would go to Contras, and $7 million would be floating around, and they don't explain where that is. In this past week, they discovered, and Mr. Hakim testified, where Bruni's money was deposited. It was in the Credit Suisse account, and they almost linked it to Mr. Zucker. We won't know whether or not that is the Zucker who got the Sultan's money that was meant to be deposited and never got to the Contras, because they asked Mr. Hakim how old Mr. Zucker was, and they asked him if his wife was a doctor and one of the members of the Iran-Contra panel. Asked what are the mathematical chances of the man getting the $10 million from the Sultan, who is that same age and whose wife is a doctor in the same city, in the same bank, Credit Suisse, and they didn't say it, but I read in the newspaper the same number. how did this get mixed up? And it's very important to know if the Sultan really meant, he said he didn't mean to arm the Contras, but this was missing a long time and was located in the Credit Suisse, and they're holding back the name of the person whose bank account it was in. Also, speaking of green money, green like Carlos Letter Rivas or Ollie North's name is green, Albert Hakim said that he refused to turn over $8 million because it belongs to the enterprise. He said, I never said I was a humanitarian, I'm in business, and he's holding $8 million. And then when the question came up, where did you find it? He said, well, Mr. Zucker had to go to banks all over the world and trace it from various places all over the world. And it ended up in the bank, in the trading company or financial establishment of Merrill Lynch. Now, Merrill Lynch was involved with the narcotics traffic and the deposit of Colombian narcotics, such as Mr. Escobar and Mr. Letter Rivas and Jorge Osha. And this came out in drug trials investigations in Washington, D.C., that were linked to the pizza parlors where our Donald Reagan, the chief of staff of the White House and former Secretary of the Treasury, was named by Judge Kaufman as being a repository of these exact accounts of these people. So the drug question is not coming out very much, but I want to bring it out because green is the name of Mr. Rivas, it's the name of Ollie North, it's one of them, and they have a lot in common in through the National Security Council in Switzerland and their contacts even going to the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. Now, Edwin Wilson was a partner of Albert Hakim and Thomas Kleins and Richard Secord at the original TCI, Stanford Technology. And Edwin Wilson was brought to the United States from Switzerland by someone he trusted, Robert Kaiser, and I've talked about him before. And Robert Kaiser's real name is Ernest von Kaiser from the Wehrmacht, worked in Hitler's army, moved to the United States, came from Sao Paulo, Brazil, where he lives most of the time. And he was working for the CIA, the National Security Council, the DIA, and then he was shot in Washington when he was carrying papers about Robert Vesco. And he also worked with Robert Vesco. At that point, when he was shot in the shoulder, he left the United States and is living in Germany. So the Mr. Wehrmacht Kaiser and Edwin Wilson and these various characters, as well as Edward Bennett Williams and Mr. Albert Hakim and Mr. Willard Zucker, who funds the North family on the side, which they brought up as real extortion, really owning the man who has the door right next to the White House. There is a lot of green floating around, and so these men use the name green, and I believe that there are a lot of things that this committee will never get out, but there will be people writing books for a long, long time, and eventually have to go to the Merrill Lynch drug connections, and the fact that all of a sudden the $8 million of Albert Hakim is sitting in the account of Merrill Lynch, but he said quite adamantly, it will not be released. In this past December 1986, there was a long article about this Zucker. Many of you don't know his name, and I thought I'd had it on the program a lot, but this article was titled American Lawyer Linked to North Associates. And sometimes it's more fun to read these older articles. This one coming out a half a year ago after hearing the testimony of Hakim and Secord and Dutton. This article talks about, in Geneva, the specialist who invests money, this 52-year-old attorney Willard Zucker, the director of a Swiss finance company, the CSF, the Compagnie des Services Judiciaires, and how they deposit for various persons around the world, and that was made quite clear by Hakim. Once you give it to Zucker, it's a secret. And this article says that he had at least seven companies that are operating out of his CSF that are tied to the National Security Council and to the likes of Secord and Hakim, particularly Secord as one of the middlemen. And the article tells about his relationship to those two key players, Secord and Hakim, and going back to their California firm, the Stanford Technology Trading and Credit Suisse, which is also the repository of the Sultan's money, that branch in Switzerland. And this article tells about the relationship when Secord and Hakim liquidated one firm in 1984 and formed another subsidiary. They liquidated the Geneva and started the Stanford Technology Group, and its offices were still with Mr. Zucker in Switzerland, that the banking and money of these people came out with Zucker's offices, and that even though Secord and Hakim merged their various companies, Hakim and Secord operated everywhere, and it lists all over the world from the Sudan to California, and Zucker was always their banker. And this article in the Washington Post, it's dated December the 14th, said Zucker came to Switzerland in 1970, that was 2 years after Nixon was elected, to work for the defunct IOS that had gone bankrupt, and it was taken over by financier Robert Vesco, and that's when Vesco took over, when Bernie Kornfield closed up. And the article goes on to say how they worked together, Vesco and Zucker, and the relationship of Hakim and Secord to their organizations. The article says that Mohammed Malik Ali, a Sudanese who runs a security device company, when he wants to recover some money from Secord and Hakim, he's told to call a number in Geneva and ask for Madame Caroline, and then he gets the phone number of Zucker, and that these people, as I say, work all over the world, and the legwork is done by Hakim and Secord, and Zucker is the banker, and he's also the banker and associate of Robert Vesco. I'll take a one-minute break and go back to another story of a lot of money, because there's a lot of green floating around and a lot of dirty deals that really should be forced to be followed, but won't do, not in these hearings, at least.